You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world. You're listening to Dr. Michelle Live. Dr. Michelle is a Catholic psychiatrist. However, the views and opinions presented by Dr. Michelle are by no means medical advice. Please consult your doctor for official medical guidance.
Welcome. I am your host, Dr. Michelle, on this road of life, Dr. Michelle Live. We're walking together. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. You can email me, dmlive@breadboxmedia.com. So today, yesterday we talked about being a misfit. And you know what? That's the best kind of fit there is. And I really, really mean that. I really mean the best people in this world are misfits. The people that you are listening to. And I can tell you, and really with all love, we are all misfits here. Every single last one of us. And you too, Jennifer. But we fit in so well with being a misfit. And you want to be a misfit. Think about every single movie you've seen, every single person you know that you think is awesome. They are misfits. Every actor's got, you know, an actress that just plays the best role, or who wrote the best screenplay, who does the best sitcom. They all have misfitting in their resume. They don't put it out there. And as somebody said when I was making a film, about these two Vietnam veterans, and I was getting to the end and I had to have it all done, and I was during my residency, and it was my idea to make it, and it had to be rather short, and had to present it, and kind of crunching in, and I was not happy with the ending. And the person that was helping me put it together, the film person who knew a lot about how to splice things together, And I said, oh my gosh, listen to that. Oh, it just, you know, it's wrong. And he said, no, when you do film, there are no mistakes. There's only choices. And what he meant by that, and I wish that we could ingrain this in our children and ingrain it in ourselves, is that when you perform anything, if you sing, if you dance, if you are an architect, maybe not an architect. I'm taking that one back because I don't know enough. Maybe the mistake would make the thing fall down. But what he meant by that, there are no mistakes, there are only choices, is that the audience rarely sees a mistake, depending on how it's presented. They see it as a choice. And if someone, that's why it's very difficult, because as a human being, when you're taking those piano lessons or those singing lessons, those guitar lessons, every time, which I'm raising my hand, every time you make a mistake, you go, oh, I'm sorry. It's like, oh, no, you stop and admit your mistake. But in those who don't, not that they don't admit it, but they just go through it, or they go ahead. And when someone sees it, they don't see the glaring mistake. They see the beautiful overall peace. So that's what we need to get to. So yeah, you know, I want to kind of continue on this road a little bit, because being a misfit, even though, you know, people go, well, I don't want to be a misfit, or it's no good to be a misfit. Well, it is good to be a misfit, because there just wouldn't be any change without us. Just wouldn't. So I want to start off with a quote of Ralph Waldo Emerson, with a very wonderful person who happens to be a colleague in the profession, has this poem tattooed on his forearm. So, and he told me about it, and it is actually quite amazing. So here is the poem. Well, first I have to get this. There it is. All right. So the poem is by Ralph Waldo Emerson. And when he told me to go ahead and look it up, he said, you're going to Google it, and there's going to be lots of people who say that Ralph Waldo Emerson never actually wrote it, but it is attributed to him, and it doesn't even matter who the heck wrote it. It's a beautiful thing. Here's the poem. Excuse me. This is the definition of success. It's just simply called success. And I'm coughing through it. Success. To laugh often and much. To win the respect of intelligent people and the affection of children. To earn the appreciation of honest critics and endure the betrayal of false friends. To appreciate beauty. To find the best in others. To leave the world a bit better. To know one life has breathed easier because you have lived. This is to have succeeded. And it's attributed to Ralph Waldo Emerson. Beautiful poem. And, you know, that's what it's all about. And I like that one line, or I like all the lines. To know one life has breathed easier because you have lived. That is succeeding. That's what it means to follow God's purpose for you. That's what it means to be part of the body of Christ. That is what it means to be inspired by the Holy Spirit, because you live. I don't care who you are, and I don't care how harmed and alone and depressed or mistakes you've made, abortions you've had, people you've killed. I mean, I've talked to many people who have done things in war, let's say, that weren't necessarily just simply fighting in war. God has forgiveness for everyone, but not just forgiveness. With that forgiveness is a replenishment in go and live life justly, rightly, in love, in life, in righteousness. Viktor Frankl, he died in his 90s. He is the famous psychiatrist and author and concentration camp survivor who wrote Man's Search for Meaning, among many other things. I read at one point many of his books, The Doctor and the Soul. There are several others. I don't recall their titles right now. But one that we used to have to read in school, in Catholic school anyway, I don't know whether it fell by the wayside, but we had to read it. And I have to say, I never read it in high school, but I remembered the title. I mean, really, I was in high school. All I wanted to do was get out of high school and do it with as little investment in anything but enjoying myself and having boyfriends. And even though I was in a girls' school and that kind of thing, I was looking forward to getting out. But Man's Search for Meaning, and during a particularly hard time, fast forward 20, 30 years, I was a particularly rough time. Oh, it was really rough. And one calamity after another in every, including my life, but my entire family's life. And I happened to remember the title, Man's Search for Meaning, because it really, I was losing my bearings. And so I picked it up. And one of the things that Viktor Frankl, it's his famous book, it has been translated in just about every language on the face of this earth and sold millions and millions and millions and millions of copies since World War II. And still very, I mean, it's pertinent today, so get a copy. One of the things he talks about, and he developed a thing called logotherapy, which you don't really hear that name or that title, but it certainly was a type of psychotherapy that didn't just live and die. It engendered, it was a seed that caused a revolution in ways of approach and ways of thinking. But one of the things that he in his Man's Search for Meaning, that he was very apt to point out throughout the whole book, is a little tiny book actually, is that at any place on the road, he talked about knowing running into a concentration camp guard someone who in his concentration camp, the very one that killed off his pregnant wife, that killed off his parents, the very camp, that there was a guard there who, of course, was just a guard. And he saw people march to the gas chambers and marched them to the gas chambers. But they met at a different, in a different venue many, 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 many years later in the free world after he had survived and he was becoming famous, and somehow they met. And he didn't hold animosity for this person, but also he talked about how this person, how that this human being was fulfilling a purpose in life, and that what he had done during this time in his life had given him, not had given him, he shouldn't have done it, but the fact he didn't stay in that place, that every human being moves on in their purpose in life. And that embodies forgiveness as far as I'm concerned. But so the point to all this, and we're going to take this up on the other side of the break, is I want to talk about what this kind of success means. I also want to talk about how you can start navigating your life in a more truthful way without being blindsided and have obstacles to actually the truth about you, about what you see in life, how you navigate through it, how you bring up a subject, who you talk to, how you interpret what they say to you. We sometimes frame it in a very different way, and it ends up hanging us up. So we're going to clarify that on the other side of the break. I'm Dr. Michelle. See you on the other side of the break.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world. You're listening to Dr. Michelle Live. Dr. Michelle is a Catholic psychiatrist. However, the views and opinions presented by Dr. Michelle are by no means medical advice. Please consult your doctor for official medical guidance.
Welcome back. I am your host, Dr. Michelle, and you're listening to Dr. Michelle Live, and you're not just listening, you're participating in, even if you have it in the background, you're participating in Dr. Michelle Live, which is our road together, all of us, every single one of us, and I'm really happy and privileged to be on it with you. It's enriching, and it is a better place, as Ralph Waldo Emerson said in the poem of success. It is a better place because, and I breathe easier because you have lived. And that's the truth. That's just the truth. In my mind, I see you all. I see you as a smattering of all the people I see outside every single day. I see you as being 84. I see you as being 37. I see you as being 27, 23, 24. I see you as 42, 44. I see you with kids. I see you with grown kids. I see you with kids at home. I see you homeschooling. I see you out in the workplace. I see you. So in my mind, even though I'm here, and you may be there doing dishes or putting some things together or driving a car, I see you here. And why is that not together? Of course it's together. You're here with me. We're holding hands. You are there. So that is not a figment of my imagination. It is my imagination, but it's no less real. So I appreciate you, all of you. And I know that we will all make it. We will. Different ways. Sometimes I get a little A little bent out of shape because I think, oh gosh, I see someone that's so much further down the road and they're half my age. And I think, gee, I wish I would have known that stuff when I was 22 or, 23 or whatever age, 30. And I didn't. I knew other things. And God brings me through for whatever reason he brings me through. For whatever reason he needs me at this particular little thread, this knot in his tapestry, at this particular point, in order to be that colored knot or that little piece of colored glass, as I like to talk about looking at the world in the little kaleidoscope way to make a gorgeous pattern that's God's pattern, however way that he needed me. I was brought through the things I went through, and who knows where it's going to go, where it's going to lead, and when he decides, okay, time to use another thread now. And we have free will. We can always say no. And when we do, as I was saying before the break, such as Viktor Frankl talking about this prison guard and talking about how his purpose in life became a blossom, a different purpose. We talked yesterday about the caterpillar and about that quote from Andre Gide, who said that, know thyself can really be harmful and damaging because if the caterpillar spent all its time knowing itself as a caterpillar, it would never become a butterfly. And that's a really cool, very interesting perspective that I thought was brilliant. Because why can't it be both and? Know thyself, pretty awesome. Be truth-sayer to yourself. But also, we have a tendency to just keep going down those little rabbit holes. And we go till we reach its end. And so sometimes we can just be so looking at what's going on inside ourselves that we don't see that we actually are moving on. So it all fits together, both what Andre Gide said, because he's right on, but also know thyself. And I don't remember now whether that was Socrates or Plato, whoever it was who said it, which was a beautiful, brilliant thing as well. We're going to talk about self-honesty. We're going to talk about why that's important. We're going to continue a little bit on how the heck to say no. We're going to do that because, see, all this weaves together. All this weaves together. So the earth is a place where I can breathe easier because you have lived. And that's an amazing thing. And no matter who you are affecting everyone around you. So, as I said in the first segment, even those of you who've done things that you feel like, then they're not necessarily for everyone's, you don't have to put it out on a buffet, a little cafeteria for everyone to see everything you've done, air your laundry for the world. You don't have to do that. Nobody has to do that. It is between you and God. At the same time, being isolated about it and clamming up to yourself can keep you stuck. And what we want to do is unstick you. And what I want to do for me is unstick me, because I can get stuck. Like I said, I can go and think, okay, I'm tooling along okay. And then I see someone else and I start regretting. I see someone else who is so farther along in the smart way to do things. The way they think about the outside world, the way they think about things, how they navigate through a family. But then I quickly realize, and I try to take a little dose of my own medicine and say, be grateful, not only be thankful for them, but be grateful for where I am now. And also, it's a little just tweaking. It's not exactly comparing yourself, but it's more of regretting your own life. And in a way, that's comparison, but in a way, it is the way that we go about saying, I see it now. Boy, look at all that I wouldn't have wasted had I seen it then. Well, that's you. That's just the bane of our existence. That's being human, and that's very painful. So when you look back and say, it hurts. I know women and men who have come back and renewed their faith or have converted to the Catholic Church or gone from atheism to belief. And they feel like if they had just done it sooner, they may not have led to whatever happened to them that caused them to be less than. I told you yesterday about that woman who became extremely devout Catholic, great woman, very unusual person, very talented, very creative, very sweet, very, but strong. She could stand up for on her own. She's even confronted priests before that she thought were out of line. And what I mean by out of line, not in the doctrine of the church, but out of line in what they might be saying about other people. And so she's a pretty strong woman, but she always felt less than, like she was not devout. She was not, something was wrong with her. God was punishing her somehow because she only had two children. And then it's like the only had two children. Well, you are where you are, and you need to be exactly where you are. Each one of those people, myself included, become a constantly evolving, changing, living piece of the tapestry. It's a living tapestry. So you can look back on, I can look back on your life, you can look back on my life, and you can have it point out, wow, there's hope down the road. Or if nothing else, it draws someone out of despair. By saying, I get you, I get it, and really get it, I've been there. And not just I've been there, but for you to see it, for you to look ahead, as I've said, that's why I love looking at people who have failed many, 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 many times. And we have lots of apostles out there who certainly fit that bill. Lots of people, look at just about anyone you can point at, as I mentioned yesterday, anyone you can point at. In the Bible, so many of them came through all kinds of failures and danger zones and being put in baskets and floated down a river, for heaven's sakes, you know? So they were enslaved or they were knocked off horses and changed the whole moment of their life by, it takes a lot to change. So when we look at this, what is the deal about self-honesty? Well, here's one of the things is that oftentimes we are afraid to admit things to ourselves, because if we actually bring it out, it hurts. It hurts because when we see it, it makes it, the word is made flesh. It solidifies it and makes it real. While we hide from it, run from it, avoid it, beat ourselves up, we can somehow let ourselves believe that, well, maybe it's not quite real. Maybe I've distorted it. Maybe it's this. Because the alternative, the reality that it is not a distortion, the reality is a thing that you're so afraid of. So we're going to talk about what to do about that on the other side of the break. I'm Dr. Michelle.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world. You're listening to Dr. Michelle Live. Dr. Michelle is a Catholic psychiatrist. However, the views and opinions presented by Dr. Michelle are by no means medical advice. Please consult your doctor for official medical guidance.
Welcome back. I am your host, Dr. Michelle. We are walking on this road together, Dr. Michelle Live, 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. And you can email me dmlive@breadboxmedia.com. All right, so there's so much to talk about. I would love to read to you this article from Viktor Frankl. It was actually an interview I don't think it was an interview. I think it was just someone writing about it on the question of God. But Viktor Frankl from Man's Search for Meaning, as I told you, Experiences in a Concentration Camp. I'm going to give you two paragraphs, and then maybe we'll get to... maybe we'll get to more of it. All right. This is about, I'm just pulling one paragraph, and hopefully it's not too much out of context for you. It says, this is when he is talking, he starts out saying, in spite of all the enforced physical and mental primitiveness of life in a concentration camp, it was possible for spiritual life to deepen. Sensitive people who were used to a rich intellectual life may have suffered much pain. They were often of a delicate constitution, but the damage to their inner selves was less. They were able to retreat from their terrible surroundings to a life of inner riches and spiritual freedom. Only in this way can one explain the apparent paradox that some prisoners of a less hardy makeup often seem to survive camp life better than did those of a robust nature. In order to make myself clear, I am forced to fall back on personal experience. Let me tell what happened on those early mornings when we had to march to our work site. Now, before I get into that, and I think I will work with him a little bit and present him to you before in the next several days, because he really is an amazing human being. And I think he was a psychologist. I know he was a practicing psychotherapist, but when he came back. But let me just say something here. This is why I go oftentimes in my programs and for myself, I do it for myself, to look at the science and the current thought of the day that all of us can Google about our mental health, Alzheimer's, weight control, inflammation, and what causes us to fail all the time and create that fear. And that's why I go and I like to say, okay, so here's an article about a woman who's 89 years old who never left Chernobyl, and she eats potatoes, and that's radioactive potatoes, and she's still living. So who are these people? Why can we just say, well, we're surely going to get Alzheimer's if we do this, 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 and this, or we're surely going to have this problem, or it's too late for me now? And it isn't too late, because I see people out there always telling me it's not too late. They are ahead of me in the road. And it's not just ahead of me. They're not like writing books and getting rich and living off the fat of the land, have a big retirement account. They're digging potatoes in Chernobyl, or somewhere around there. And they have a room with a chair, and they've lived there their whole lives, and it's cold, and it's harsh, and it's awful, and there's radioactive stuff. And I doubt that they go off to their local bookstore or shop on Amazon for how to be the healthiest me so that I can live forever. I just don't think that's working. I don't think that's what they do. So, when he talks about this, and he talks about the intellectuals, the rich spiritual lives, these people who survived a concentration camp, and sometimes they're surviving more or better than the people that are, you know, buff, basically, the people that are more robust, the worker, the people who were strong and never sick. And, you know, I I'm going off the subject just a tad, but I want to give you a not a completely current example, but a more current example. When I was in medical school, I was in medical school during a time when the family century farms in the Midwest were being taken over by big corporations. So here's something I knew nothing about: family farms. Knew nothing about century farms, farms that had been in the family for at least a century, that the father's 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 father, that they somehow came, settled, and that's where the person came from, that stock handed down from generation to generation. I didn't know about those things. They was just not in my world. So here we are. And one of the things we had to do in medical school as a medical student is do physical exams. You know, we just would go to the hospitals and do physical exams. That's how we learned. Just little second year medical students. But I started noticing, it's like, wow, sure, getting a lot of these 85, 86, 87-year-old farmers who never had gone to a doctor in their lives. Never gone to a doctor in their lives. God-fearing people, ate off the farm. But what did they all have in common? All of a sudden, now you could say, well, they were 85 or they were 86. But all of a sudden, in droves, there they were. And I'm just doing physicals. And they're there because it is a physical. You have to get the chief complaint. What is your problem? Why are you here? Why are you walking into this doctor's office? Why are you walking into the hospital? What's this about? Well, they had all kinds of ailments. I can't stop being tired. My stomach hurts all the time. I'm getting arthritis. I'm feeling this. I'm feeling that. All right. What they all really had in common is that they were in an impossible situation where they weren't in a position to say no to the big companies. They had a 20-year history of buying some things on credit, having good interest rates. Everything seemed fine, just like we did with the housing market. And it forced people to become dependent. And then when it came time for everything to switch in the outside world, so to speak, it could have all been orchestrated over a period of time. And people have actuarials. Businesses do this all the time. It's how hospitals did it, or insurance companies did it to buy out hospitals. But you go ahead and you let them continue on and everything's fine, maybe for 10, 20 years. And then all of a sudden they can't meet the demands, or the landscape has changed a bit. And whoop, lo and behold, some great big companies buying out your neighbor and your neighbor and your neighbor. And you're thinking, that's never going to happen to me. Well, it did happen to them, because all of a sudden they can't keep up. All of a sudden the big companies are selling food at a much lower price than the family farmer can do. And one thing leads to another, and the bank needs to have its loan paid off, and they're not making what they were making. And you get a little bit of nature running in there, maybe giving you a bad season, and pretty soon they're losing their farm too. And they have absolutely no way of dealing with it. No way of knowing, no way of rolling with those punches, or they're toughest people on the face of this earth. But when it came to that, to their whole heritage being gone, they started getting sick. So yeah, you can say on the one hand, yeah, they're old. No, that's not, doesn't explain it. Didn't explain it. Certainly didn't explain it to me. So when Viktor Frankl writes this, he is in a concentration camp himself. His pregnant wife was killed. His mother and father were killed in a concentration camp. And he, as he was an intellectual, he can say with all certainty, they were often of a delicate constitution, these intellectuals, but the people that were sensitive and used to a rich, there's just those types of people, and rich, they're used to that rich intellectual life. Why did some spiritually oriented people Why did they fare better? And we're going to get into that on the other side of the break, because this has everything to do with you, everything to do with your spiritual life, your physical life, and how you navigate the rest of your life. Well, this is Dr. Michelle. We're going to talk about this on the other side of the break, but I want to give you again my phone number, 573-4BREAD-4. You can either you can call, you could be anonymous, you can text. You can also email me at any time, DM live at breadboxmedia.com. So many of you have emailed, and it is you give me ideas. You tell me what you want to hear. You tell me all the little intricacies of your particular life stories. You may have one pressing question on your mind. Was, should I see a doctor about taking the medication I'm taking? I feel better, but I'm a little worried about it. And then as you go on, you tell me about things in your life. You question, you wonder, and this is where it's about. We're also going to get a little bit to today to why it is important to say it out loud, even if you're writing. This is Dr. Michelle. See you on the other side of the book.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world. You're listening to Dr. Michelle Live. Dr. Michelle is a Catholic psychiatrist. However, the views and opinions presented by Dr. Michelle are by no means medical advice. Please consult your doctor for official medical guidance.
Welcome back. I am your host, Dr. Michelle, and you're walking with me on Dr. Michelle Live today and every day. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. And you can email me any old time you'd like, DM live at breadboxmedia.com. All right. So we're talking about Viktor Frankl. So let me finish reading this here. I'm not going to read the whole article, just this little, it's about this is the question of God. And I'm not even sure who's writing this actually. So I'm not even sure what their orientation is as far as spirituality or anything else. But this is great. So in what I read you before, he was talking about the physical and mental primitiveness of the life in the concentration camp and how, in spite of how it was so awful, I mean, primitiveness, when he, if you read the book, which is a small book, it's hard to even imagine. But he talked about the damage to the inner self was less for those who were spiritual or who had a rich intellectual life. But then he also clarified as well that they were able to retreat from their terrible surroundings to a life of inner riches and spiritual freedom. So that was very paradoxical in the way that the people that were less hardy physically, you know, they were bespeckled and they were, you know, not as, they just, their muscles weren't as developed, but they actually fared better. So then he says, let me tell you what happened on those early mornings when we had to march to our work site. We don't have time to go into all that today, but I want to do that. He talks about how they shouted their commands and how the words were just ringing in his ears. Everything was to detach, to march. And it was just all about marching. And he said, who didn't march smartly, even though they were starving, was kicked or beaten. And then he says, worse off was the man who, because of the cold, had pulled his cap over his ears before permission was given. So every part of their dignity was being trampled upon before they were possibly killed. And and really almost certainly killed. He said they stumbled in the darkness over big stones through large puddles along the one road leading from the camp. The accompanying guards kept shouting at us and driving us with the butts of their rifles. Anyone with very sore feet supported himself on his neighbor's arm. Hardly a word was spoken. The icy wind did not encourage talk. Hiding his mouth behind his upturned collar, the man marching next to me whispered suddenly, quote, "If our wives could see us now, I do hope they are better off in their camps and don't know what is happening to us." That's just so touching. And then he said it brought thoughts of his own wife. And as they stumbled on for miles, dragging one another, they said nothing, but they both knew. Each of us was thinking of his wife. Occasionally, I looked at the sky where the stars were fading and the pink light of the morning was beginning to spread behind a dark bank of clouds. But my mind clung to my wife's image. Makes me cry. Imagining it with uncanny acuteness, I heard her answering me, saw her smile, her frank and encouraging look. Real or not, her look was then more luminous than the sun, which was beginning to rise. A thought transfixed me. For the first time in my life, I saw the truth as it is set into song by so many poets, proclaimed as a final wisdom by so many thinkers, the truth that love is the, as I'm going to cry, that love is the ultimate and the highest goal to which man can aspire. Then I grasped the meaning of the greatest secret that human poetry and human thought and belief have to impart. The salvation of man is through love and in love. I understood how a man who has nothing left in this world still may know bliss, be it only for a brief moment, in the contemplation of his beloved. In a position of utter desolation, when man cannot express himself in positive action, when his only achievement may consist in enduring his sufferings in the right way, an honorable way, in such a position, man can, through loving contemplation of the image he carries of his beloved, achieve fulfillment. For the first time in my life, I was able to understand the meaning of the words, quote, "The angels are lost in perpetual contemplation of an infinite glory." And then he goes on to talk further. And we today, this is like our last segment. So we are going to probably get a little bit more on this, but let me read that one more time. We're going to talk about this a little bit tomorrow. I want to read that again. And when I read it again, I want you to think about your beloved. And your beloved, you can be as alone as anything, and your beloved could be God, should be God. And if you have the tangible evidence of God on earth, someone you love, a person in the flesh that you love or have loved, think on that. But it's God. And we talk about the angels, his quote, and I got to find out where that quote came from. "The angels are lost in perpetual contemplation. I messed it up twice. The angels are lost in perpetual contemplation of an infinite glory. So this time I want you to think about it, because it's talking up. He is talking about truth on the bare bones of truth, that the weak rise. The weak of body, the outward appearance of weakness, of being a misfit, not here in the concentration camp, but as we talked about yesterday, you plug in the blank. You fill in the blank. Because I'm talking to you in 2016. And if you're listening to this, you aren't now being taken out and shot or strangled as that girl was by her brother for honor, or the old priest who was killed You aren't doing that if you're listening to this. You aren't one of those people today. Viktor Frankl at one point was not one of those people. He gives a story. He gives a story of which I thought was beautiful. I when I was researching him 20 years ago, of being a young man and in Vienna, I think he was in Vienna at the time, but World War II was breaking out. And, you know, it's kind of like it still wasn't as real, but he was Jewish and it was like, oh, you know what? We better start thinking about this. And there was a church, a synagogue that he had gone to with his family throughout all of his life. And he walked through it, and it still was not real yet what would happen to them. And he had gotten a job, I think, in the United States because he was a pretty awesome guy, and he was an intellectual. And he had gotten a job at some university. It might have even been Stanford in the United States. And he had a pregnant wife. And he was thinking, yeah, maybe I should do this job, but he didn't know what to do because he saw what was happening. And so he almost decided to take this job. And when he was walking along, wondering, what should I do, God? What should I do? And he didn't know exactly what to do. Should he take this job? Should he not? He had his parents here. And so he said he was walking and the synagogue had been bombed. And he thought he had actually at that point decided, as far as I recall anyway, to take the job. And he thought he would get like a stone or some little thing that he would give to his father in remembrance of the synagogue because it was gone now. And so he's like walking by and he just bends down. He picks a piece of rubble and he takes it home. It's just a charred wood. And he takes it home. And he decides to clean it up a little bit for his father as a little gift and as a remembrance of their synagogue. And as he's cleaning it up, he realizes that there's something etched in it. There's some writing etched in it in Hebrew. And the words were akin to, well, the words were, and it was just on one tiny piece of wood. Get this now. This is how God works. Honor thy mother and thy father. And at that moment, he knew God's answer. He had to stay. And that decision caused him to be in a concentration camp, his parents to be in a concentration camp, and his, well, not his parents, but his wife, his pregnant wife. And you could look at it one way and go, oh boy, wrong decision. No. This man, he would have been a professor at Stanford, and he probably would have had his child and his wife, and that would have been that. This man's call was different. His wife's call was different. His everything about this, millions, if not getting on billion, of people have known about him and his book. He has altered the lives of humanity by that one decision, which caused not only great, 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 great suffering, but also for the person he loved to be killed. So this is Dr. Michelle. We will look at this tomorrow. God bless you. Dr. Michelle Live.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.